when our single ventricles don't survive, very frequently the time of death is in the interstage.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
Alice, will you tell us who we're speaking with today?
Yes. Today, we're having Dr. Greg Jurecek on to talk about the post-op Norwood. Dr. Jurecek is a longtime cardiac intensivist at Children's National. He's also the director of our critical care simulation program, and he is the fellow lecturer that you want to make sure you attend.
That's right. Today is our final part in our multi-episode series on the postoperative Norwood. Here we step back a little bit and we think about big picture things in the postoperative period: shunt anticoagulation, extubation, for transfer, getting that patient through the interstage and getting them ready for the Glenn.
Yes, this is a must listen if you are a new PICU fellow. Let's get right to the content.
Now that we have this framework for how to optimize these kids, we're going to set you up with some scenarios that maybe aren't going so well.
Sure.
I want to hear your differential diagnosis, maybe your initial steps for your approach. So you got this, we'll say Norwood Sano, and you're going into your first 12 hours post-op, maybe you're on call that night, and you're worried that you're seeing signs of low cardiac output. Maybe the NEARs are dropping, maybe the central venous sat is dropping, and the lactate is smoldering up somewhat, and the pulses aren't so great. What are you worried about in that scenario?
Oh boy, what am I not worried about? So there's so much that could be going on, right? So first of all, this child had probably the most complicated operation we could do a couple hours ago. So you have to think about anything related to the operation. So low cardiac output syndrome, of course, implies the actual surgery went well and there's not a lot of residual disease. It's just we're dealing with a temporary phenomenon as far as the child recovering from bypass. So I think the first thing you want to do here is get an echo and just get a look at the ventricular function. Make sure there's not any new valvar regurge. Is there fluid around the heart? And that can happen even with an open chest. You don't get a lot of information about Sano or BTT shunt patency with an echo with an open chest, right? Because you have very limited views just pretty much through the belly. But you get what you can get. Even if it's just function and AV valve regurge, that's a good place to start. The next thing I'd ask myself is, how precipitous is this? Were things okay and now we got one bad gas and the lactate went from 2.5 to 4.5 and now it's 8? So let's take that scenario. If that's the kind of situation that you're referring to, the surgeons need to be at the bedside and we would have a discussion about mechanical support right then and there. If it's just that we're smoldering, like you said, and maybe the lactate's going up a little bit and the NEARs are going down a little bit, I would try to sort of optimize some of the stuff that we talked about before. Maybe they need more volume. Maybe go up a little bit on the volume replenishment strategy. Target an ICAL 1.2, 1.3. Target a crit maybe over 40. Ensure they're well sedated and neuromuscularly blocked. Ensure the EEG doesn't show seizures or something else that could be consuming oxygen, something occult. Do a KUB and make sure there's not free air in the belly, which is something that can cause occult hyperlactatemia. So do a good survey. You could do all those things in probably an hour. A little more volume, titrate your alpha a little, make sure the function isn't bad, because that would be obviously very concerning, and make sure there aren't other sort of extra cardiac or like cardiac related but non-surgical issues as far as why they would have some of the parameter changes that you're mentioning. If those cannot be explained, I'd go right back to the first thing, which is make sure a surgeon is there and that you're talking about whether we should be thinking electively about mechanical support.
Well, very interesting and all great stuff. You mentioned EEG, so maybe this is a bit of Easter egg here. Maybe most of your Norwoods come back with EEG on. Is that right?
We put it on the first night, and we didn't where I worked previously, and we didn't for the first few years of where I work now, but we have been. The thought there was that there's a little bit of data now that seizures in a neonate is not uncommon after bypass. You know, in Norwood, you're talking typically 3 hours of bypass. I mean, every surgeon's different, but that's not uncommon, and it can be longer. You're talking about a significant amount of clamp time. That's when the heart stopped altogether. And then there's a certain amount of time where the child needs to have deep hypothermic arrest, right, where there's no blood, and the child is cooled to a very, very low temperature. And that's when they're doing things like the arch work. For all those reasons, there is significant risk for reperfusion injury as the child is taken off bypass and ultimately perfusing their own organs again. And the brain is definitely at risk. So we've been doing this for a couple of years, putting EEGs on neonates, especially because they're paralyzed in this case and you don't have an exam, to get a feel if there is any evidence of seizures. I'll say it doesn't happen all that much, but when we do see it, we can act on it right away instead of finding out like 2 days later when we wake them up.
Nice.
So, Greg, so you have another patient. You also have another Norwood BTT shunt, and you get called to the bedside, and that patient's acutely hypoxemic. What's going through your mind?
That's another classic, Zach. So, of course, you want to first make sure it's not an equipment issue, right? So there would be things going through your mind. Just make sure that the tube is in, right? And make sure that the chest is moving. How quickly did this happen? And then, of course, you need to listen, right? So if the child has a BTT shunt, open-chested or not, you should still be able to hear a shunt murmur, and you should still have solid end tidal, right, on your monitor. If you have lost end tidal, or at least a lot of your end tidal, and you can't establish whether there's a murmur or not, and it's been precipitous, you would have to be worried about a shunt occlusion. That is an emergency, obviously, and there's a few different things that you can do for that. They can work variably well. If this child isn't doing great to begin with, and they have a shunt occlusion, they unfortunately will probably have a cardiac arrest, no matter what you do. If they're kind of hanging in there and doing all right, and it's not fully occluded, you may be able to get away by giving some heparin. We'll typically give 50 units per kilo per heparin. I'll often just give a bunch of volume up front while I'm getting the heparin ready, because just conceptually speaking, you're trying to move stuff through theoretically, and heparin doesn't break up clots anyway. And you might give some epi while this is all happening. I think you're going to have to do that if the sats are low, because the child's not going to tolerate that. So while you're doing that, you're calling a surgeon who, if the chest is open, can actually sterilely take the membrane down and milk the shunt right then and there. That's another benefit. The shunt's actually readily available, so to speak, both a sono and a BTT via an open chest. And that might be a way that you could avoid an arrest and or ECMO, but your job as the intensivist, as soon as you've gotten the surgeon coming, you've given the heparin, you've talked about we're giving epi, this is what we're doing, you have an ECMO circuit completely prepared, you're priming it right now, because the chance that the patient that you describe is going on mechanical support is upwards of 75%, I'd say.
Nice.
Yeah, so great. And certainly a very, very nerve-wracking situation to walk into.
It really can be. And again, it, sometimes when you see that happen, it can look like you've just got bronchospasm, right? All of a sudden, the sats are really, really low. So, I mean, one of the terrifying things about this business is, you know, some things that happen all the time in intubated kids can look like the huge problem things that mm-hmm. get us all worried. And so having a mental model of, yeah, we're always going to keep in our mind that this could be a new postoperative issue because this kid just got an operation, but also tube placement, a big water dump from the ET tube, mm-hmm. an equipment thing, and there's a leak in the system and they're not getting any of the gas that they're supposed to be getting. Bronchospasm, the tube fell out. All those things still can happen, unfortunately, in a post-op Norwood, just like a bronchiolytic.
You certainly can't leave your ABC approach, and you probably get no brownie points if you call in the surgeon and the circuit's disconnected on the ventilator.
I won't say I've been exactly in that situation, but I've been in situations similar to that. It can be embarrassing, but if the kid's okay, it's a lot less embarrassing.
Ultimately a relief that your shunt is
yes.
patent.
Exactly.
All right. It's 4 a.m, 5 a.m. You've done a single lap around the remainder of the unit. You've printed the sign out. What do you expect this patient to have completed? What are your signs that things went well?
So what I'd love to see in a kid like this is, remember we talked about the establishment of the reserve, so to speak, whether it's volume, that vasoactive approach, which again, I can't emphasize enough that that's just a way that I've done over the years. It is not at all the only way to do this. You've established that you have good ventilation, that your systemic to pulmonary shunt or your sono is working well, your numbers are looking pretty good. And really where I like to be is the beginning of a diuretic phase. We love to say, oh, you know, they're established diuresis overnight, and then we'll talk about chest closure in the morning. And that can happen. But you don't always have to have that as your only goal. It's not a failure if you present to your surgical and medical staff at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning a Norwood who is still very much in a slump, still working with a volume replenishment strategy, still in a decent amount of vasoactive support, and maybe the lactate, which peaked at 6, is 4, but they're doing okay, and they're going to start their diuretic phase at 10 o'clock that morning. So it is important, like, you can push these kids too far. If they're not ready to diurese and you give them diuretics, it's probably not going to be harmful. They just won't make urine. But don't insist that they get to certain phases. Let the baby talk to you. If you still are in that build the reserve phase, just stay in it. You're okay. You're making decisions now that are going to affect the child for a long period of time. Does not matter if the chest is closed tomorrow or the next day. It'd be nice if it's today, but it really isn't that important. I wanted to just leave with that. It's often we as intensivists, we love to be right, and we love to set our morning team up as these are the things that I did, and it is clear that they have all worked. Mm-hmm. That's not always the case. These are the hardest kids in my mind to take care of. And it's okay if you don't meet your goals all the way. That said, where I would love to be, to answer your question, is that we have in fact begun that diuresis phase. I usually will put these kids around 4 or 6 in the morning on like a diuretic drip, sometimes with a little bit of Lasix and then a little bit of a drip. Keep everything else the same. And if they're starting to make urine, sometimes we'll take that fluid replenishment strategy, if that's something that you choose, and have it or stop it, right? Because obviously the more you're giving in, the more positive you're going to be. And see if the child tolerates, if the blood pressure's good and the heart rate's good and they don't seem to need that volume back, maybe they're tightening up a little bit. Maybe their capillary leak is improving. That's great. That's what you wanted. Maybe you gave some steroids, maybe you didn't. But either way, your approach seems to be working well. And then it's really that next day, Alice, that we are talking about getting a good day of diuresis toward chest closure. That at most places, you know, the three places I've worked at is frequently the second day after a Norwood as opposed to the first. I've seen places do it the day after and it's fine. I've seen places wait and it's fine. But as far as a mental model, when I walk in, let's say I wasn't the person on overnight and there was a Norwood done the day before, my focus, as long as we feel this is a good operation with not a lot of residual disease and metabolically the child is moving along, is going to be really on fluid restricting this kid and getting as much urine out as I can and keeping that PD drain open and shrinking that little baby down to get the chest closed, which is a really important step in the process.
Certainly a great mental model. If you just get through the first night with some form of hemodynamic stability and a creation of a reserve, that seems like a win for this kid.
And it is a win. It definitely is.
So in the past few minutes, we've been really granular, talking on maybe the minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour changes that you see for this kid. For the rest of our talk, we'll maybe broaden somewhat and think about things in maybe days or shifts. How do you prevent this newly placed shunt from occluding? What do you do for shunt occlusion prophylaxis?
So typically what we will do is add some sort of heparin within 4 to 6 hours after the operation, and that would be for a BTT shunt or a sono. And then we try to get some antiplatelet agent, and at least conceptually speaking, and there isn't a lot of data on this, but conceptually speaking, they would be the best at preventing shunt problems, right? Because you have a foreign piece of material there. But there's always been a concern of giving antiplatelet agents, which are not easily reversible, to a kid who's been back from the OR for 4 hours. If you give it in their tummy, are they going to absorb it? And if you give it systemically, you can't reverse it. So the approach has typically been heparin or a heparin analog or something like bivalrudin, direct thrombin inhibitor, which is really starting to take off. And some places are using that now as shunt prophylaxis for the first day to 2 days. And then when we start feeds, typically we will begin enteral aspirin once a day. It's really hard to know if the approach is effective because these cases are rare and shunt occlusions, fortunately, are even more rare. But this approach has been accepted by most of the medical and surgical community. And the other thing that we'll often do when they're on an antiplatelet agent for usually 5 days, is we'll send a TEG or a thromboelastogram. And that's a way just to look for some of those fun things we learned in med school, AA inhibition, arachidonic acid inhibition, and ADP inhibition, to give us some science behind is what we're giving this child every day, whether it's aspirin and Lovenox or just aspirin or it's aspirin and Plavix or whatever it is we're doing, do we have any numbers we can put to it that make us feel that this shunt is going to be safe going forward?
Nice. So you've had a good couple of days. You've gotten the chest closed. You're weaning things. When are we extubating this child?
Oh, it's the best day, right? The parents are always so excited for that. You know, it's incredible how within the first couple of days, they'll move from this phase almost universally of really being afraid to be in the room, see their little baby, to a level of comfort with our jargon, with what's going on, to what progress means, to what we're worried about. And they're usually pretty stoked for extubation day, I find. And some folks will really want the family in the room for the extubation, and some people won't. But no matter what, you want to make sure your family knows it's happening because it's a big deal. So I think of this, Alice, as it's really nice to think, what I challenge the fellows on at night is, extubation should generally occur 24 hours after chest closure, right? In an ideal situation, because presumably you've done your diuretics to get the chest closed. Then there's usually a little bit of capillary leak again, and sometimes a bit of a need for volume, but that stabilizes out typically in a couple of hours. And now you're lifting muscle relaxant, the child's beginning to wiggle, and you're weaning from the vent. And if they went to the operating room, not on a ventilator, which would be well over 95% of Norwoods would be in that category, can you extubate them? My experience is it usually is closer to 2 days, but I challenge our trainees and our nursing staff to see how ready can we make this kid by tomorrow? Like, let's keep working with the diuretics. Let's really go down on the sedation. We've established a really nice sedation protocol here where when we think within 24 or 36 hours of extubation, we're actively weaning sedation so that we don't come in on the extubation day and the child's still on a moderate dose fentanyl drip and a bunch of Presidex and the blockade was only lifted 4 hours ago. So we try to protocolize some things, which I think is helping a bit. And then coming into that extubation day, again, not just reserve this time, I would use a different word, optimization. So robust hematocrit, right? Because usually once you get through that first night, you don't necessarily need a crit of 43 in your Norwood, right? But you might want a crit of 40 on the day you extubate, right? You might want to do some support trials to see how well the diaphragms move. You know, they're on their ventilator without a rate. Watching their chest move is very important. What does the x-ray look like? What's the body wall edema look like? Have there been any intercurrent things? New bleeding, infectious concerns, seizures, an abdominal issue. Those things are all going to delay extubation. But to me, 24 hours is the perfect time if you could really nail it. 48 hours is sort of the usual time, I guess I would say, as far as getting ready to extubate them. And if you'd like, maybe we go through some of the causes for extubation failure in this, if you'd like to move to that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So, you know, these kiddos can fail for all of the usual reasons that you can in a PICU. And this is really where knowing your critical care is so important when you're taking care of these kids. So they can have all of the non-cardiac things, right? They can simply be weak. Right? It could be that simple. This baby's probably not fed all that much, and they've now had a huge operation. They've been neuromuscularly blocked for 2 or 3 days. They may just be weak. They may retain CO2 and they may fail. They could have a new lung problem, a pneumonia or an infection, right, associated with the ventilator, right? They could have too much fluid on board, interstitial or pulmonary edema. They could have not the greatest oxygen delivery because they're anemic, any issues like that, right? And then you, on top of that, because those things can happen too, think about the cardiac stuff. So some of them are post-operative, a diaphragm issue, right? The phrenic nerve can be injured, damaged, or in rare cases, clipped as part of the actual operation. It's usually more like when the surgeons are pushing the lungs back into the chest. And as a result, you can have paresis or paralysis of one of the diaphragms. As you guys remember, babies use their diaphragms to breathe. That's like what they do, right? We can use our intercostals if we have a diaphragm paresis. Babies can't. And a baby with a 7 or 10 day old child with even a unilateral diaphragm paresis is not going to extubate successfully in my experience. And so typically those kids will fail and then they'll need to go for an investigation and have the diaphragm plicated, which would be the subject of a different thing. They also can have vocal cord issues. Remember the recurrent laryngeal nerve, right? Runs right in the area where these surgeons are operating. They can have unilateral or bilateral vocal cord paresis where the cords are not opening and closing normally. This can lead to issues breathing, but also issues swallowing and protecting the airway later on. So those are surgical things that would certainly concern me. And then the last would be physiology, just the stuff what Zach was saying before. What are we looking at here? Do we have really good systemic output? Is our pulmonary blood flow really controlled? Is this a BTT shunt whose PaO2 is 50 and whose heart still looks really big on x-ray and who has bounding pulses and we're trying to extubate them today? Maybe we should rethink about this. Or is this a patient whose sono is a little small and we're doing great, guys, but on the pre-extubation readiness gas, we did it with an FiO2 of 80%, right? These should be the kind of things that make you concerned because these little friends do not have a whole lot of reserve. So those are the things that I think about as far as extubation readiness. They're all the things you already would in the PICU, but think about specific surgical issues. Certainly after the chest is closed, you're going to do another echo. AV valve regurge, a huge thing that can slow these kids down and often something we can't deal with surgically right away. Ventricular function, good flow to both PAs, neoaortic insufficiency, that sort of stuff. You want to make sure that stuff's okay. And something that we haven't talked about at all, and I kind of feel bad we're this far into it without, is arrhythmia, right? These kids can get arrhythmias. They can have reinternal arrhythmias just as part of their heart disease. They can have automatic arrhythmias like atopic atrial tachycardia, less common things like JET for this particular lesion, but that can give them imperfect output and they need to be spot on all 8 cylinders in order to get extubated. So make sure that you are treating any ectopy with really good electrolyte management and treating any arrhythmias with an electrophysiologist and really that you have all that stuff settled out before you think about extubating them.
Nice.
What a great response. And this, you know, knowing when to extubate a Norwood patient really tests everything that you has to do with your skills as an intensivist. And of course, your procedural skills, you need to place the tube right back where it came from. Assuming you're at a higher volume center, when are these patients typically transitioned out of the ICU?
So that's pretty variable. We've been kind of talking about your ideal Norwood patient, which would be a 3-ish kilo child with no other major issues, born at term, who goes to the OR at day 4. And the chest is closed in day 6, and they're extubated at day 8. This is a beautiful course that we've set forth. And typically what we would be doing for the next week or so is introducing feeds, which would be NG and then ultimately PO. Sometimes they'll get a speech eval, make sure their swallowing is okay. Remember, we talked about the vocal cord thing. And then slowly wean from one of the more important medicines that we use with this, which is milrinone, to typically we move these kids to some sort of enteral afterload reduction. The idea, again, is lowering SVR should promote systemic blood flow and limit pulmonary blood flow when you have a resistor in the pulmonary line, which is what the shunt is. And so typically we will move these kids to enteral medicines that would replace, so to speak, the milrinone and get their diuretics enteral and make sure that they're able to feed. That's usually about a week, and we typically don't, at least at this institution, transfer these kids out until they're completely enterally fed, like no TPN, and starting to take some PO feed. So your ICU course could be 2 weeks, and honestly, I've seen it less than that, and we, of course, have all seen it much longer than that. And then they're going to the floor basically for nutrition. They've never learned to just be a baby, right? To just be able to wean from the medicines that, you know, like the diuretics that you have them on. They should hopefully need less of that over time as their kidneys are maturing and being able to take by mouth. And that's the biggest thing, is sort of weaning them from the NG tube. And that typically can take another week to 2 weeks. So a lot of centers will say to families, plan on your child being in the hospital for roughly a month, with the first 2 of those weeks being in the cardiac ICU. I think that's a very reasonable thing. That's what I say to my pre-op patients all the time. But I'll be honest, it's pretty variable.
Well, that's very fair. The baby will have to show us. When you think about moving this kid from a stage 1 to now they're in the interstage period, one of the highest risk periods, how do you think about the complications of surgery?
One thing that is very well established in this business is that when our single ventricles don't survive, they very frequently, the time of death is in the interstage. It's soon after their Norwood, or it's sometime between their Norwood and their stage 2 procedure, which is when they get the cavopulmonary anastomosis. That makes sense, right? During that period of time, first of all, the child's spending a fair amount of the time as a neonate. So by definition, they're going to have immature lungs, immature kidneys, and just be less robust. But the other is just think of the interstage way, right? You have this single ventricle. In the case we're talking about here, a right ventricle, which is not meant to do any of this stuff, and a tricuspid valve, which is not meant to do any of this stuff. And it's pumping 2 or more cardiac outputs to the body, right? It's pumping 1 to the system, 1 or more typically to the lungs. Like, it would not be atypical in the interstage patient for, say, the pulmonary blood flow as ratioed to the systemic blood flow to be, say, 1.5 to 1. That would not be uncommon. But that means that this ventricle is pumping 2.5 or more cardiac outputs every beat of every minute of every hour of every day. And that's why we believe these kids are so vulnerable to have readmissions, cardiac arrests, and even mortalities in the interstage. Moving them toward the Glenn physiology has sort of long been established as being a more stable circulation, and probably in addition to the child simply being bigger and a natural selection bias, and that you're only doing the Glenn on the interstage patients who have survived, is that the ventricle now is just pumping out to the aorta, right, or the neoaorta. And so the blood flow to the lungs is all happening passively and then mixing with the systemic venous blood. So there's a real advantage there. And that's why, you know, you do a Glenn, they're typically pretty robust. They're often hypertensive. They start feeding better. There's all sorts of good stuff that happens after the Glenn. But to answer your question about interstage mortality, what we do know is, in looking through the SVR trial, as you mentioned, where they showed survival to a year was in the 80 to 85% range, which is amazing, right? To a lesion that we wouldn't have even addressed 25, 30 years ago. But when you look at the mortality, most of that mortality is before they actually get the Glenn. So then the idea is, how soon can you do the Glenn? It's very, very attractive. What you're really waiting for is some somatic growth. You're making sure the PAs are growing well, right? Because you're going to be plugging the SVC into them. You want to make sure there's really good lung health and the pulmonary vascular resistance remains low, and that there's good neurodevelopmental progress and continued growth in every other organ too. So that's why there's been a bit of a back and forth as far as early Glenn, something that used to be done at 8 to 10 months early on, and is now typically, as Zach pointed out, more like 3 to 6 months. Once we get these kids to Glenn, that hospitalization is typically brief. The ICU stay is typically 1 or 2 days. The hospital stay is typically 7 to 10 days, and they're home.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jurasek. Again, as we're coming near to the end of today's conversation and I reflect on it, I really can't think of much that would be more high yield for an incoming critical care fellow and really anyone along the way in their training. This is just a scenario we think about and deal with and manage almost every time we're in the cardiac ICU. So I want to thank you, of course, for that. Anything else that you wanted to cover before we wrap things up today?
No, thanks, Zach. I really appreciate those thoughts. You know, I took many years to figure this stuff out. Don't forget the families. And remember that when you meet these amazing parents for the first time, that you're probably going to be establishing a relationship with them for weeks or maybe even months. Mm-hmm. And they're going to remember you and your name and your style and how you lead and how you carry yourself. And I know that's probably outside of the sorts of things that we normally talk about with here, but we're now in a phase where we've really changed over the last few years, and we're offering single ventricle palliations to kids that are way more high risk than before. Premature kids that we will grow until they're near term or 2.5 kilos and then try to do this operation we talked about today. Children who may have concerns for genetic anomalies and many, many other issues like extracardiac problems, native lung problems, things like that. And as a result, our length of stay for kids like that is going up and up and up. And so when these kiddos go through their operation, they still have a day one Norwood day. And that's what we talked about today. But remember that they may still be there 3 months after the Norwood. And establishing that relationship and that trust and everything is just a really important part of all the stuff we talk about.
A powerful reminder, and we appreciate it. You know, Zach, if you're a listener and you enjoyed this series, I do have a recommendation for further listening.
What's that?
There's a physician named Greg Kelly in Australia who does this phenomenal podcast called Pediatrica Intensiva, and their first series is a single ventricle series. And so if you enjoyed this, I really think you should go over and listen to their single ventricle series. I have listened to it twice, and I got much more out of it after I had done a couple CICU months. I feel like it's really a fascinating discussion.
Oh, I agree. I remember them having an episode on borderline left hearts and the sick interstage patients. I really appreciate it. I think I learned so much from them.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Pete's Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Pete's Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening.